Good day. Today is Thursday, 29th January 2026. And as always, let me remind you before I start this programme, if once you've watched this programme, if you like what you've heard, please remember to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. Well, as we start today, there are growing rumours, in fact, no, not rumours, indications of an imminent United States, US attack upon Iran. Apparently, all of the major regional powers, the Saudis, the other Gulf states, Turkey, are busy trying to get President Trump, the United States, to pull back from this attack. There's some suggestions that the Russians are involved as well, but to be frank, I've seen no evidence of this myself. Certainly no Russian official that I'm aware of has been contacting or speaking to the Americans about this matter. But anyway, the regional countries are trying to get the United States to hold back from this attack. Several of the Gulf states, the Arab Gulf states, have said that they are closing their airspace and they don't want the United States to be using their airspace for attacks upon Iran. And the Iranians themselves, as I discussed in my program yesterday, are warning of retaliation if or perhaps when the attack comes, and they're making it increasingly clear that they are prepared this time to go all the way and to close the Gulf of Hormuz and to take even stronger retaliatory action should that be needed. There's been an article by Alistair Crook in which he says that the Iranian leadership has apparently made a decision that if an attack is made by the United States on this occasion, then it makes no sense any longer for Iran to pull its punches. It's done that previously on several occasions. It's sought in that way to achieve some kind of deterrence factor, showing to the Americans and to the Israelis that Iran is in a position to hit back. The Americans and the Israelis are disregarding these messages. On the contrary, they're seeing Iranian restraint as a sign of weakness and are treating it as an opportunity to attack further. And in light of this, rather than pull punches this time, which at best would result in another temporary ceasefire, which would lead to a further attack, a process which over time would sap Iran's energy and its strength, the Iranians this time are saying to themselves that in this case, if there were an attack, all restraints would be thrown off and Iran would retaliate in every way that it could, up to and including closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Now, saying that this is what the Iranians are saying, and they're saying it apparently in private, public statements by Iranian officials seem to be in line with this, these acts of defiance, but what is being reported by Alistair Crook and, as we will see shortly, by Reuters, what is being reported by them as the what the Iranians are saying is being said in private. Anyway, whether the Iranians really have the intentions or the capabilities to do these things which they are saying, well, I don't know. It does seem to me that they almost certainly do have a capability to close the Gulf of Hormuz. They came fairly close to doing it, or apparently they took the first steps to do it during the June 12-day war. But, well, as I said, I'm not going to speculate on Iranian actions at this point in this programme. All I'm saying is that there is growing alarm in the Middle East by the Arab states, by Turkey, about these threats of military action by the United States, and growing statements, stronger, ever stronger statements of defiance from Iran. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, the Iranians seem to be taking steps to prepare their country for war, for a long war with the United States. So, will an American attack come? Well, the first thing I get to say about that is that I have been predicting an attack by the United States on Iran from the moment the 12-day war in June last year ended. I made the point many, many times that it seemed to me that there was unfinished business from that war. The 12-day war in June was launched with the obvious purpose of regime change in Iran, of overthrowing the government of Iran. The way it was intended to be done was through a decapitation strike carried out against the Iranian leadership, the objective being to throw the whole of Iran into chaos and to hope or plan for this to cause the collapse of the government and of the entire political system there. And the Iranians, to my astonishment, were caught by surprise. They ignored the fact that articles in the American media all spoke about an imminent Israeli attack on Iran. They were lulled into complacency by the fact that their chief negotiator, Foreign Minister Araghchi, was due to meet Witkoff in Oman, and they seemed to have told themselves that no possible attack could conceivably be launched before those discussions in Oman took place. And quite a few Iranian officials were indeed killed on the first day of the attack, but not enough of them. The government survived, all of the leading people survived, and the government and the military leadership reconstituted themselves. And not only that, but Iran went back on the attack and it began to carry out strikes using long-range missiles against Israel. And these began to do increasing amounts of damage. And Israel and the United States began to run out of air defense interceptors. And the Iranians started to talk about and take the first steps towards a closure of the Straits of Hormuz. And Israel and the United States called the whole thing off, asked Iran for a ceasefire, and a ceasefire was agreed. And that was what basically happened during the 12-day war. And that, of course, left the government of Iran in place. President Trump claimed that the American strikes on Fordow and Natanz and all of these other places had essentially obliterated Iran's nuclear enrichment program. There were many doubts expressed about that by many people, including myself, by the way. But anyway, that is what President Trump said. And it seemed to me that given that the objective, the true objective, which was not to stop Iran enriching uranium, but to overthrow the government there, that since that had not been achieved, and given the centrality of Iran and the importance that Israel and the United States have given to Iran's role in creating resistance to them in the Middle East, and their repeated talk about the need to end Iran's activities, break its power in the Middle East, achieve regime change there, cut off the head of the snake, to use the Israeli formula, it seemed to be inevitable that at some point, fairly soon, another attack on Iran, a bigger attack on Iran, would come. And in fact, in many programs, I discussed this and I said that I expected it to happen before the end of the year, 2025. Well, it didn't happen before the end of the year, but in December, on the 28th of December, to be precise, Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump met. From recollection, I think it was in Florida. They both appear to have agreed that another attack on Iran should take place. And, of course, all of this happened at the same time as there seems to have been an attack on the Iranian currency. I say seems to have been. There have been economic problems building in Iran throughout 2025, which I think are partly the responsibility of President Pezeshkian's government. But I'm not going to revisit that topic now. Anyway, it seems that there was an attack on the currency, the Iranian currency, in the financial markets in Dubai. The currency collapsed. That led to protests. The protests then led to violence. The violence is, I think, widely acknowledged now to have been, to some extent at least, organized from outside, by people in Israel and the United States and elsewhere. There were some hopes in early January that the protests and the attacks on various centers in Iran would suffice to bring about the collapse of the government. The government, however, managed to gain control of the situation. The Starlink terminals that were being used to coordinate the protests were jammed. I've discussed that in many programs. I've discussed how it seems that the technology to do this came from Russia. Though some continue to say China, but I believe it was Russia. And I have reasons to believe that. But again, I'm not going to get into the details of this now. And anyway, the protests, after a great deal of violence and following the deaths of 3,000 people, according to the Iranian authorities, over 2,000 protesters, a significant number of the Iranian security forces, and around 600 people who the Iranian authorities claim were organizers of the violence or participants in the violence. Anyway, after the internet was shut down, after Starlink was jammed, after the Iranian authorities regained control of the situation on the streets, after calm in the country was restored, well, at that point it became clear that any expectations, any hopes that the protests would lead to a collapse of the government in Iran were wishful thinking. And as at the time of making this program, the Iranian government seems to be in firm control of the country. Now, none of this is at all surprising. It is, in fact, exactly what I would have anticipated in light of what I have been saying ever since the June war, that an attempt to overthrow the government of Iran, another regime change attempt, another attack on Iran was certain to come. And I thought it would be before the end of 2025. Instead, it's happened in the first month of 2026. But I don't think that this is, frankly, of any significance. Well, now we have a huge concentration of US naval assets around Iran. And Larry Johnson on Sonar 21, his invaluable blog, has compared the size of US naval and military assets positioned around Iran today with the concentration of US naval and military assets close to Iran in June. And he makes the point that the force that has been concentrated today is significantly more powerful than the one we saw in June. Moreover, it includes a US Navy supercarrier, the Abraham Lincoln, whereas in June, the United States did not have a supercarrier in the region. So an enormous build-up of US military power. And here it is worth pointing out that the first reports about movements of US forces to the Middle East, to the area close to Iran, began to appear in early December, before the meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu on the 28th of December. And the orders to deploy this huge naval force to the area of to the area close to Iran began, those orders were given, and those ships started to move before the protests were quelled. And despite reports that President Trump had called off the idea of a strike on Iran in the immediate aftermath of the protests, the instructions to deploy this huge force close to Iran was never rescinded. So it seems to me that this build-up has been in preparation since at least the beginning of December, and it's gone forward relentlessly ever since. And well, the only conclusion I can draw from that is that this must have been the intention to prepare for a strike against Iran all along. And the protests at the beginning of this month, at the end of December, and at the beginning of this month, must be understood and must be discussed always in the context of these enormous military preparations which have been underway. Now, I am not going to explore in this programme why the United States, why the President of the United States seems to be so focused on regime change in Iran. There are lots of geostrategic objectives which he perhaps believes he can achieve. Perhaps there's also a sense here that if he can overthrow the government of Iran, this will be an enormous event that will enhance his prestige and popularity in the United States. It seems to me also that with President Trump, there is also a personal issue. It's been obvious to me from the moment he became president in 2017 that, like many Americans, not just within the administration, but in wider American society, he has a strong vicarious loathing of the Iranian government and of the political system in Iran. And perhaps he nurses a sense of grievance from the events of 1979, the seizure of the American hostages in the US embassy in Iran and all of that. Whatever the reasons, whatever the motivations, the fact is that certainly since June, he has been working, he has been seeking regime change in one form or another of the government of Iran. And anyone who looks at this enormous concentration of forces that is now taking place close to Iran, and aware of this visceral attitude that President Trump and many of his officials, I'm not saying by any means all of them, have about Iran, anyone looking at all of this ought to recognise that sooner or later some kind of strike against Iran is going to happen. Now, I'm going to just add a few important points, at least to me, they are important things which we should not overlook and forget. Yesterday, the president made a very fiery statement about Iran on Truth Social. He spoke about the mighty armada that he's deploying close to Iran. He talked about how it was moving with force and power and motivation towards Iran. He warned the Iranians that the attack on them, if they didn't do a deal with him, in other words, capitulate to his demands, would be far greater than what happened in June. And he linked the whole issue again to Iran's nuclear program, its nuclear enrichment program. He said in capitals, he capitalized it, that Iran must not have a nuclear weapon. And the thing that struck me about this instantly was that in this Truth Social post, he didn't actually refer to the protesters. It was all previously, over the last couple of weeks, whilst the protests were underway, the president, Donald Trump, gave the strong impression that if he did take military action against Iran, it would be military action because of action Iran was taking to suppress the protests. Trump was worried, apparently, allegedly, about the fate of the protesters, about the killing and execution of the protesters. Well, that was the excuse a week, 2 weeks ago. Suddenly, the reason is different. We're back to talking about nuclear enrichment. The protesters are forgotten, or at least maybe not forgotten exactly, but they've been put, shall we say, they've been filed away in a lower drawer, ready, no doubt, to be brought out again when the moment comes. So we're back to nuclear enrichment. Now, the problem I have with this is twofold. Firstly, if there is a crisis over Iran's nuclear enrichment capabilities, which, by the way, I should say, I don't think there is, Iran, the government of Iran, the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, have repeatedly said that they do not seek and have no intention of acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. As I have pointed out in many programs, back especially, I remember, at the end of 2024, various Iranian officials were making commentaries on the Iranian media in which they made it fairly obvious that they thought that Iran should acquire a nuclear weapons capability and that they were being prevented from doing so due to the opposition based on religious grounds of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, all of their objections went nowhere. Khamenei continues to insist that Iran will not acquire nuclear weapons. There is a religious prohibition against it. He will not be moved on this question. The president of Iran, President Pezeshkian, appears from genuine conviction to share his view. So despite Iran enriching uranium to very high levels, it seems that there is really no danger at any immediate point in time of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. Besides, and it's a point my colleague and friend Alex Christoforou makes many times, back in 2015, Iran agreed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with the United States, various Western powers, and Russia, which in effect placed significant restrictions on its nuclear enrichment program, set up a very elaborate system of inspectors, all of which in its totality made it impossible for Iran to enrich uranium to the level needed to create a nuclear weapon, and made it, in fact, impossible for Iran to obtain or develop a nuclear weapon whilst the JCPOA was in place. The JCPOA, no doubt, had its flaws, had its weaknesses. I've discussed them in previous programs. But whilst it was in effect, it would not be true, it would be untrue to say that there was any risk, any proximate risk of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, putting aside the religious objections of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. The person who, of course, tore up the JCPOA and therefore opened up a possible route for Iran to acquire nuclear weapons was no less a person, none other than President Trump himself, who did so over the course of his first term. So you could argue that to the extent that there is a problem arising from Iran's nuclear enrichment program, the person who must bear a heavy share of the responsibility for it is none other than President Trump himself. That's the first thing I wanted to say. Well, that is historic, but there's something else which is much more recent. During the 12-day war, President Trump insisted that the US attacks on Fordow, Natanz, Isfahan, and the other Iranian nuclear sites had in effect obliterated, I believe that was his word, Iran's nuclear enrichment program. He took it very amiss when a report from the US Defense Intelligence Agency suggested otherwise. He said that it was completely wrong, and the Pentagon subsequently walked back that report. He continued to insist that everybody who said that Iran's capabilities had not been obliterated and that the strike on Fordow and the other places had not been an astounding success, that everybody who said that or insinuated it was completely and entirely wrong. And now, just a few months later, he is preparing to attack Iran again, or saying he will, because apparently he's still worried that Iran might acquire a nuclear bomb. It seems to me that maybe, just maybe, he is acknowledging here that his great military strike on Fordow, Natanz, Isfahan and all of those other places back in June was not quite the resounding success which he alleged after all. Anyway, I am not going to explore further President Trump's ultimately constantly fluctuating reasons for the operation that he's ultimately going to launch against Iran. Suffice to say that it is not about Iran's nuclear enrichment program. It is not about the threat of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, which is very unlikely to happen indeed. Impossible, I would say, whilst Ayatollah Khamenei remains alive. It is about his, Donald Trump's, desire for regime change in Iran. And, well, that is the unfinished business, and that is what it seems to me that he's going to try to do over the next couple of days, couple of weeks. Apparently, there was a meeting between Iranian officials and American officials in Oman over the last couple of days. There's no word who was involved in this meeting on either side. Apparently, at this meeting, the Americans presented the Iranians with a list of demands. The demands, as far as I can tell, included that Iran give up any question of nuclear enrichment engaging in nuclear enrichment at any level whatsoever, entirely, and hand over all of its nuclear facilities to the United States. Iran, in other words, should abandon, give up a right which all members, all signatories of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty have been given, which is to explore the civilian use of nuclear energy, which nuclear enrichment can also be a part. Anyway, that was one demand. The second was that Iran give up all of its long-range ballistic missiles and commit to developing only medium-range missiles, missiles with a cap on their range. The third was that Iran abandon all its regional allies, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Hezbollah militias in Iraq, the Houthis in Yemen. And the fourth was that Iran also carry out various other changes to its overall policies, the aggregate effect of which would have been a complete capitulation by Iran, or so it seems to me, to a degree that might have actually called into question the entire stability of the political system there. I mean, these are, on their face, extraordinary demands. Some would say outrageous demands. And, of course, the Iranians rejected them. So, to me, this does not look like a genuine negotiation position. It's rather like the famous ultimatum that the Habsburgs delivered to Serbia in 1914, after the assassination of the heir to the Habsburg throne. That ultimatum was also couched in extreme terms, such as would have, in effect, ended Serbia's independence, reduced it to a vassal of the Habsburgs. And, of course, that ultimatum was drafted in order so that it would be rejected, precipitating a war. And it seems to me that this demand that the Americans made to the Iranians in Oman must be understood in the same way. Now, we have a very interesting article in Reuters, the British news agency, which discusses this whole matter. And it talks, its title is Trump Weighs Iran Strikes to Inspire Renewed Protests, Sources Say. And then we go on to read. President Trump this is the first paragraph, is weighing options against Iran that include targeted strikes on security forces and leaders to inspire protesters, multiple sources said, even as Israeli and Arab officials said air power alone would not topple the clerical rulers. And there it is. The purpose is to topple the clerical rulers. Otherwise, why say, why warn that this operation, if it only involves air power, is not going to be successful? And then we're told the two sources familiar with the discussions that Trump wanted to create conditions for regime change. There it is. It's there in Reuters. It's straightforwardly said in Reuters. Reuters has put the words regime change in quotation marks. I'm not sure why, by the way, but anyway, the words are there. After a crackdown crushed a nationwide protest movement earlier this month. And to do so, he was looking at options to hit commanders and institutions Washington holds responsible for the violence, to give protesters the confidence that they could overrun government and security buildings. Trump has not yet made a final decision. And then we're told that the options discussed by Trump's aides also concluded a much larger strike intended to have lasting impact, possibly against ballistic missiles that can reach US allies in the Middle East. US allies in the Middle East, of course, means Israel, or its nuclear enrichment program. And then we're told that Iran has been unwilling to negotiate restrictions on the missiles, which it sees as its only deterrence against Israel. Well, there it is. So Reuters straightforwardly tells us that it is regime change. And the idea apparently is to attack various internal security agencies of the Iranian government in order to provide opportunities for the protests to resume again, in the anticipation that this will lead to a tremendous resurgence of the protests, leading ultimately to the overthrow of the government. In other words, regime change. And we're then told, however, that there are sceptics, and four Arab officials, three Western diplomats and a senior Western source, whose governments were briefed on the discussions, said they were concerned that instead of bringing people onto the streets, US strikes could weaken a movement already in shock after the repression by the authorities. And we're then also told that there are warnings from Israel that the Israelis do not believe airstrikes alone can topple the Islamic Republic, if that is Washington's goal. If you're going to topple the regime, you have to put boots on the ground, an Israeli official told Reuters, noting that even if the United States killed Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran would have a new leader that will replace him. Only a combination of external pressure and an organized domestic opposition could shift Iran's political trajectory. And the Israeli official said Iran's leadership had been weakened by the unrest, but remained firmly in control despite the ongoing deep economic crisis that sparked the protest. And then we go on to read that multiple US intelligence reports reached a similar conclusion, that the conditions that led to the protest were still in place, the weakening the government, but without major fractures. And so the logic of it is that mere airstrikes by themselves are not going to be enough. The government is resilient enough. It has enough internal support in Iran. The systems of power are too well organized, too well embedded, too well supported to be overthrown by airstrikes alone. And, well, if you're going to overthrow the government of Iran, the Israelis are saying you need boots on the ground. You need some kind of invasion force to enter Iran in order to do it. And then we are told that the government system in Iran is diffused and resilient, and that there is a real possibility that if the current leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is killed or somehow removed from power, then the institution that will most likely take control would be the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And that, quote again, any success seen as emerging under foreign pressure would be rejected and could strengthen, not weaken, the IRGC. So we are also told that there is a risk that if the operation is indeed successful, and if the government does indeed fall, Iran might disintegrate, there might be a civil war in the country, which would of course be a geopolitical disaster as well. The gravest risk is fragmentation into early stage Syria with rival units and provinces fighting for territory and resources. So anyway, there we go. It's the nonetheless, despite all of these warnings, despite the fact that the US's own intelligence agencies are reporting that a collapse of the regime is probably beyond reach by air power alone, despite the Israelis having their doubts, despite the Arab states warning that this is an incredibly bad idea and that they are not in favour of it, despite all of that, all of the indications are that the United States, in some form or other, nonetheless, plans to go ahead. Now, all of this is not my analysis. It is there in Reuters. You could see it. It comes from US intelligence agencies, Western governments, the Israelis. All of these people are giving these warnings, but it doesn't seem to have, for the moment at least, any sway on decision making in Washington. And I would finish by quickly adding here that I get the impression that when there is talk about putting boots on the ground and that this is the only way to do it, I do wonder whether there aren't actually plans to do something like that. The Reuters article talks about the successful capture of the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, in Venezuela, in Caracas, whether there are some hopes, some ideas, some fantasies maybe, of achieving something similar in Iran. The who amongst this incredibly complex and very varied system of officials that exists in Iran would be the person that the United States would seek to abduct is a complete mystery to me. Anyway, I say all of this. Again, I think it is possible, it is highly likely, perhaps even all but inevitable, that an American attack nonetheless is going to come. The Israelis may be getting cold feet, or at least some of them may be, as the enormity of what is being sought perhaps hits home, though always there will be people in Israel who press for an attack on Iran. There may be many, many doubts in Washington, but as is always the case with Donald Trump, as is always the case with any administration, if you gather together a vast force, if you make demands which cannot be met, if you are Donald Trump and you are afraid of losing face, in one form or another, somehow or other, you will launch your attack on Iran. Now, it may be, because we are talking about Donald Trump, who doesn't generally like prolonged wars, that if the operation doesn't achieve its objectives in the first few days, he will try, as he did in June, to gradually wind it down and call it off. It might not be so easy to do this time. Firstly, the Iranians are saying that they won't let it happen. They won't let it end in the same way as they did in June. That this time they will hit back, and they will hit back hard, and they will continue hitting hard until the Americans finally understand that Iran is not going away. So it may be that this is going to be a longer, more difficult, more prolonged war than Donald Trump expects. There are also threats coming from Iran to do extreme things like close the Straits of Hormuz. Were that to happen, we would probably very quickly see an explosion in energy prices. There's already great instability in the financial markets. The dollar has been losing value. Gold and silver have been rising. There are stresses in some debt markets also apparently, if we add something like this, a surge in oil prices, because oil cannot be exported through the Great Gates, through the Straits of Hormuz, well, the economic consequences will be extremely grave, including in the United States itself. So, and of course, if the war continues, if the Iranians do continue to launch missiles against Israel, if we see the same depletion of air defense interceptors that we saw during the war in June, and I can't see how that would not happen. There's been some interceptors produced since then, but as I said previously, not enough to replace the losses that took place in June, or plug the many gaps that have arisen since. Well, if that happens, and if this time the Iranians refuse a ceasefire, unless the Americans and the Israelis commit to things which they might find it all but politically impossible to commit to, such as dismantling American bases in the Gulf, for example, well, then I can again imagine that the pressure in Washington and Israel to escalate might increase to incredibly dangerous levels. So what we're about to see, what we are on the brink of, is the most extreme, the most reckless gamble that any president has made since, well, I don't even want to guess for how long. And nonetheless, all the indications at the moment is that President Trump is inclined to take that gamble. Now, of course, gambles can sometimes come off. It may be that he will achieve what he wants to achieve. He may be able to oust President Ayatollah Khamenei, replace him with someone more compliant. The Reuters article says that that's the idea, to repeat the Venezuela formula, keep the regime in place, but replace it with a more compliant leader. It may be that things will indeed work out that way. I personally think that the risks involved in this gamble are so high that it simply is not worth it. I also have to say that I cannot imagine two countries more different from each other than Venezuela and Iran. I think the idea that something that worked in Venezuela might work in Iran is facile, to say the least. I would add that over the last couple of days, Delcy Rodriguez has been starting to push back against the Americans. She's beginning to become more assertive. She's refusing, apparently, American demands to cut off Venezuela's connections to Russia and China and Iran, and has been making noises indicating that she wants to reassert herself. I suspect that she has to do that in order to reassure other members of the government in Venezuela that she is in fact an independent figure and is not in America's pocket. But we could see anyway that the great success in Venezuela so far has not delivered on the various things that President Trump perhaps expected that it would so far. So gambling on doing the same thing in Iran, a country so different and so much more complicated and so much more powerful than Venezuela, when it hasn't yet even worked in Venezuela, seems to me even more unwise. But Well, it remains for the president to decide. He appears to be the sole decision maker. Congress, as always, has abdicated all responsibility. I'm not even aware of any serious effort in Congress to debate this issue, let alone push back on it. And, well, we'll just have to wait and see. Well, there it is. That I discussed the situation in Iran as in as much detail as I feel I can in this programme. We're in a war of nerves. It's just possible, I suppose, that the Arab states especially will be able to persuade President Trump to pull back. I don't think so myself, but at least it does appear that that is what they're trying to do. I think it is much more likely that we will see an attack on Iran. And then, of course, the same calculus applies as applied during the 12-day war. If within the first 24, 48, 72 hours, the operation is not successful, if the government of Iran is still intact after the attack, if it is able to function and continues to function and retains control of the country, then the huge size of Iran, its depth of resources will start to come into play, and the calculus of the war will change, with the balance starting to swing in Iran's favour, with all of the problems for the president and his officials that that will give rise to. But anyway, we will see what happens and we will see how this thing plays out. But for the moment, at least, just to finish, I personally do expect a strike on Iran. I personally think it is most likely to happen this weekend. I may be wrong. I hope I am, but I don't see anything good coming out of this affair. Now, I've talked about Iran. I've touched on Venezuela. I'm going to very briefly say something else about another country that the United States appears to have in its sights, and that is Cuba. There's been an article in the Financial Times that says that Cuba only has 2 to 4 weeks of oil left. It is indeed the case that the oil supply from Venezuela has now stopped. Cuba turned to Mexico for oil. Mexico has supplied Cuba with some oil. The United States has been objecting about this and has been putting pressure on Mexico to stop supplying oil. There were reports that one Mexican delivery of oil to Cuba was stopped, but President Sheinbaum of Mexico says that it is not true that Mexico will not supply oil to Cuba, and that Mexico does indeed intend to go on supplying oil to Cuba. Meanwhile, there is a deepening economic crisis in Cuba, though, as in Iran, for the moment at least, it seems that the government of Cuba is still firmly in control. Now, in my opinion, Cuba has also made serious mistakes. It overinvested in Maduro. It, of course, took steps to try to protect him personally. He had a Cuban bodyguard. It neglected opportunities to hedge its oil supplies with old partners. It did import oil to some extent from Mexico alongside Venezuela. And of course, Cuba does produce some oil itself. But despite the Russians repeatedly telling Cuba that they are allies, it never went back to its old historic oil supplier, which was Russia. The Russians have, by the way, made further statements about Cuba. the Foreign Ministry issued a report strongly criticising any American blockade of Cuba. And the report finished, "We reaffirm our unwavering solidarity with the people and authorities of fraternal Cuba." Brotherly Cuba, again, it reinforces the point about Cuba being an ally. The Russians, when they repeat these words, fraternal Cuba, when Putin calls Cuba an ally, they are in effect telling the Cubans that if Cuba asks them for help, the Russians will give it. And what the help the Russians will give will, of course, be in the form of oil. Now, I again struggle to understand why in this situation the Cubans aren't asking the Russians for help. Some things have been happening between Russia and Cuba over the last few weeks. Since President Trump became president, the United States has massively tightened its visa controls so that Western travelers who go to Cuba from Europe or Canada for holidays might find it impossible to get visas to enter the United States. That has, in effect, destroyed Cuba's once thriving tourist industry, or so I understand. The Russians, who previously sent some of their tourists to Venezuela, are now diverting them to Cuba instead. The Russians are not affected in the same way. So there is some commercial contact between Cuba and Russia that has developed over the last few months. But given all that was happening, given that all has been happening between the United States and Venezuela for several months now, I find it very difficult to understand why the Cubans, who must have realised, who ought to have realised that the pressures from the United States against Venezuela were mounting, I find it very difficult to understand why the Cubans didn't hedge and seek oil from the one reliable supplier able to supply Cuba very easily with all the oil that it needs and to escort it with its warships, if it chooses, which is Russia. The Russians, it seems to me, are all but telling the Cubans, come and ask. I suspect that the reason, again, is that the Cubans aren't very keen on having the Russians come back. They worry that if the Russians do come back, they might, for example, suggest, or perhaps more than suggest, changes in the way that the Cuban economy functions, which the Cubans themselves might not be happy with. But anyway, all I am saying is that the pressure on them is enormous. President Trump is talking about the collapse of Cuba this year. Unless the Cubans do something, that might very well turn out to be right. Again, I don't understand why help that is there and which can be taken is not being sought. I would have expected Cuban officials to be coming to Moscow to be discussing the crisis with the Russians, the Cuban president perhaps to be flying to Moscow and other Cuban officials sorting out the deals, agreeing the arrangements. Again, it bewilders me that this isn't being done. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say. Now let's turn to the perennial topic of these programmes, which is the situation in Ukraine and the conflict there. Now, Peskov confirmed that the next meeting, the next tripartite the next meeting of the Tripartite Working Party is due to happen, perhaps on the 1st of February, though that is not apparently a definite date, but certainly at some point in early February. Witkoff and Kushner, exactly as I predicted, will not be there. Pentagon officials presumably will be there this time. My guess is it will be Dan Driscoll or someone else from the Pentagon. The Russians have repeatedly said that as far as they are concerned, this is a working party dealing with military and security issues. It is not there to draft or agree the outlines of a final peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine. The Americans will be there, but they're going to be sending only technical people this time. The Russians will probably send the same people that they sent to the last meeting, headed by Admiral Kostyukov, the head of the Russian Military Intelligence Agency, the agency that continues to be called in the West, and by the way in Russia, still amongst most people, the GRU. As for the Ukrainians, well, we will see who turns up. But my guess is that since it is now clear that this working party is not going to be the place where any great diplomatic breakthrough is achieved, we are going to see the Ukrainian delegation also downgraded significantly. People like Budanov, Umerov, Arakhamia probably won't go this time. I doubt even that military officials like Gnatov, the chief of general staff, will be there. It might be Skibitsky, the deputy head of Ukrainian military intelligence, or someone at that level. So this was always envisaged by the Russians to be a working party, and this is what it is now becoming. Now, there's been an enormous amount of confusion and misinformation about this affair, or rather, I won't say misinformation, but a lot of misleading stories told about this particular working party. There's a number of things to say. Firstly, some American officials, Witkoff in particular, have been putting about the story that the only issue in contention continues to be is the question of the Ukrainian pullout from Donbass. There's been two exceptional articles, one by Jennifer Kavanaugh in Unheard, and the other by Gordon Hahn on his indispensable blog, Substack site, I should say, both saying that this is obviously wrong. The title of Jennifer Kavanaugh's article is "Conceding Donetsk Won't End the War in Ukraine." The Russians have a whole list of other things that they consider as important. Demilitarization of Ukraine, return of Ukraine's neutral status, agreements that Ukraine cannot join NATO, restoration of rights of Russians and of the Russian Orthodox Church. Up to this point in time, none of that has been discussed, and the Russians repeatedly say that these all remain for them central issues in the war. When they talk about root causes, that is what they talk about. The Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has spoken about this question many, many times. He has said that for the Russians, the key question is not territory. It is security. Security for Russians in Russia itself. In other words, security for the Russian state from the perceived threat caused by NATO's eastward expansion in violation of promises made to the Soviet and Russian leaders at the time that the Soviet Union broke up, and security for Russians or Russian speakers in Ukraine itself, their ability to speak their own language, to practice their own religion, to lead their own lives in the way that is supposed to be protected by human rights legislation and international treaties that apply to everyone else. That is what the Russians repeatedly say. And they have never, at any point, in any of the negotiations, in any of the discussions, pulled back from this. The Russians talk always, when they meet with the Americans, about Anchorage, about what was discussed in Anchorage, about the Anchorage formula. But Putin, at Anchorage, in the press conference that took place directly following his meeting with Trump, again referred to the root causes that must be resolved and insisted that all of these were needed in order to achieve peace in Ukraine. And root causes extends to all of these issues that I have just mentioned. So, obviously, a withdrawal from Donbass, from Donetsk, by the Ukrainians is important. And I do get the sense that when Putin met Witkoff in Moscow in July, and when Putin met Trump in Anchorage in August, the Russians said, well, if we're going to negotiate, if we're going to move towards a genuine peace, then obviously a withdrawal by the Ukrainians from Donbass would be an important first step, but it would only be a first step. It would not by itself end the war. It would simply open up, it might open up, however, a route towards future successful negotiations. Jennifer Kavanagh has put it best. A further problem is that Ukraine's territorial concession would not mark the end of the conflict. Senior Russian officials have repeatedly made clear that Ukraine's withdrawal from Donetsk is a precondition for starting negotiations and would not guarantee the end of the war. After Kiev cedes the rest of Donetsk, an emboldened Moscow hopes negotiations will move on to other topics, including the size of Ukraine's military, its non-aligned status with NATO, ties to Europe, and the protection of Russian language. In this sense, the concession of Donetsk would be the precondition to later outlining the true causes of the war. Now, all of this, the nature of the Russian position, was made very clear in congressional testimony by the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, which took place yesterday. Rubio covered all kinds of topics. He talked about Venezuela, he talked about Iran. He didn't say anything about either issue that seemed to depart much from the Trump administration orthodoxies. Though I should say that my own sense was that on Iran, he is not especially engaged in the matter. He's far more focused on Venezuela and perhaps Cuba than he is on Iran. Iran is being driven by the president himself and by some of his other officials. My guess is Mike Walls, the US's UN ambassador, who was previously Trump's national security advisor, might quite probably be playing a central role again. Just to say. Anyway, Rubio did, however, talk again about Ukraine. And he again talked about the territorial issue. And he appeared, as American officials often do, to link the territorial question in some way with the issue of Ukraine being given security guarantees. And he seemed to say that the deal was that Ukraine pull out of Donbass, no mention here of Zaporozhye and Kherson, and in return, as part of a final peace deal, the United States gives Ukraine security guarantees. The US would, these security guarantees would in themselves not amount to very much from an American point of view. There might be a few French troops deployed to Western Ukraine, but the Americans would be there providing some kind of backstop, which it was unclear what that meant. Anyway, the key thing is that Rubio was then asked, have the Russians agreed to this? And the answer was no. So this key issue remains completely unaddressed. So there are no security guarantees from the Americans because the Russians have not agreed to them. And the reason the Russians have not agreed to them is because, of course, they've repeatedly said that they will not entertain the idea of the presence of Western troops in any form in Ukraine. And the reason also they have not agreed to them is because there's been no discussion so far, no substantive discussion so far about this issue. And again, Jennifer Kavanaugh puts it well. She says the security guarantees offered by the United States or Europe would almost certainly be litigated during the next round of discussions, the one that would happen after the Ukrainians pulled out of Donbass, as Russia would have a stronger battlefield advantage through control over Donetsk. Understanding this, in other words, the Russians would litigate it, they would oppose it, and they would oppose it from a stronger position than the one that they are in now. Understanding this, Ukrainian leaders can never accept a territory for security guarantees bargain because, just to finish that sentence in my own words, that bargain is simply not there. The Russians are not offering American security guarantees to Ukraine in return for the remainder of Donbass. They've never given the slightest hint that they are. The reality is that these negotiations are stuck. They are going nowhere because the Ukrainians refuse to withdraw from Donbass and all of the other issues have not yet been discussed. And that discussion would take a very, very long time. And as I've discussed in several programmes, and as Gordon Hahn, by the way, has pointed out, Ukraine ultimately does not have that time. Now, we've since learned that the Ukrainians did again bring up, Ukrainians and the Americans did again bring up the topic of an energy ceasefire with the Russians. I have already said that I believe that Witkoff and Kushner floated that idea to Putin during their last meeting. And Ushakov's account of the meeting, if that is correct, makes it clear that Putin rejected the idea of the ceasefire. The latest reports say that the Americans and the Ukrainians brought it up again during the Abu Dhabi meeting, and the Russians said no. They are not prepared to agree to ceasefires of any sort until and unless a final agreement is achieved. And in fact, over the last few hours, President Zelensky has come out and is giving warnings that another big Russian missile strike is on the way. There's been reports that the Russians have been attacking and destroying radar systems, Ukraine's radar systems, its early warning systems, in anticipation of another big, which, as so many are seeing, as indicating another big Russian strike on Ukraine over the next couple of hours. And that, by the way, almost certainly is true. And, well, we will see where this goes. In my programme yesterday, I talked about a likely big Russian offensive over the next couple of weeks or months. There's been a very interesting discussion by the Russian analyst Sergei Politayev about the future direction of the war. He too anticipates a Russian offensive. He predicts that the Russian offensive will be in Donbass, in two places. Firstly, in Donbass, to capture the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. He says this will be a complex and enormous operation, which will need to be carried out. It would require much of 2026 to achieve. And he also says that the other big operation will be in Zaporozhye, in aiming to capture the city of Zaporozhye itself. These would be the two most important Russian military objectives on the ground in 2026. So Politayev expects a big Russian offensives, or at least to be more precise, two of them. And the Ukrainians are also now talking about a Russian offensive. They say that 80,000 Russian troops are now concentrating around Slavyansk. And this is the northern of the two cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And that they are clearly expecting a big Russian offensive there. Well, we shall see. As I said already, many of the actions that the Russians are taking, the attacks on the energy systems, the attacks on the transport systems, the attacks on the radar stations, the detailed reconnaissance carried out by the Russian drones, all of that looks to me consistent with preparations for some sort of big offensive over the next few weeks and months. This offensive, if it does achieve those objectives, captures Donbass and the city of Zaporozhye, would be a knockout blow. After that, after the loss of these places, Ukraine would be, well, not totally helpless, but it is difficult to see how Ukraine would be able to continue to function as a state without an agreement, a peace agreement with the Russians. Just saying. Anyway, that's probably what we're going to see over the course of 2026. And of course, as I've said many times, the capture of Zaporozhye and probably Kherson city as well over the course of 2026 opens the way to Odessa, which I strongly believe is the ultimate Russian objective. Perhaps Odessa in the south, Kiev in the north, in which case the Ukrainian state, as we have known it, will cease to exist. Anyway, that I suspect, in its essentials, is the Russian plan. And I don't see any sign of a diplomatic breakthrough, and I don't believe that such a diplomatic breakthrough is going to come. And that, I think, is the only thing that can stop such a breakthrough from happening. Anyway, it's the only thing that can stop such an offensive from happening. Now, Turning now briefly to the military situation, there are more and more reports about a critical situation for the Ukrainians in Krasny Liman and of the Russians pushing forward hard north of Pokrovsk in the Dobropilia area and of the Russians tightening their grip on Konstantinovka. The battles in Donbass continue and the Russians do seem to be moving steadily closer to Slavyansk itself. It's winter, the logistics are still disorganized. Much of the work I suspect that the Russians are doing at the moment is getting the railway lines that they have captured in various places and the road lines working. And it's been pointed out that in Kupiansk, the capture of Kupiansk-Uzlovoy, which more and more people are now quietly accepting, has almost certainly happened, has brought the Russians control of a key railway station, and that if the Russians are able to refurbish it and sort out the railways that pass through Kupiansk, then this is going to again also significantly simplify their logistics in northern Donbass and in southern Kharkiv region as well. So all of this is happening in the north, in the northern places. Perhaps the most dramatic news is from Zaporozhye region. It is now apparently widely acknowledged that Gerasimov's claim that the Russians have captured the village of Novoyakovka is northwest of Orekhov is true. And Radovka yesterday claimed that the Russians have almost completed the capture of the village of Ternovata in eastern Zaporozhye region, west of Guliapolye, that Ukrainian defences there have collapsed, and Ternovata, it is generally acknowledged, is a key to the remaining Ukrainian defence system east of Orekhov. If Ternovata falls to the Russians, then the way is open for the Russians to continue their advance to Orekhov from the east. So the pincers on Orekhov seem likely to close. Radovka, which clearly does have connections with the Russian military, incidentally spoke of a mystery that Ukrainian reinforcements to Zaporozhye region are few and low in quality. There is apparently some puzzlement about this on the part of the Russian command. There are worries, or rather discussions, about whether the Ukrainians might be building up a strike force to conduct some kind of a counterattack. Or it could be that the situation in Donbass is now becoming so threatening for the Ukrainians, and with the Americans placing so much weight on the situation in Donbass, the Ukrainians feel that they can't pull back from Donbass. They have to continue to defend Donbass. So despite the importance of Zaporozhye and of Orekhov, the best Ukrainian reinforcements continue to be sent to Donbass. Anyway, we shall see. For the record, there are also reports that General Sirsky is now touring Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, making sure that these cities are properly fortified. It looks as if the Ukrainians are indeed going to make a stand for these cities, that they're going to try to defend these cities. A decision which, frankly, makes my heart sink, because given the current configuration in the line in the of the front lines, it seems to me that a last stand in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk almost certainly dooms the Ukrainian forces instructed to hold these two cities, to defend these two cities, to a disastrous fate and to what I have described as the biggest cauldron in the war. Anyway, there it is. That is the situation in Ukraine today. The big news, the news that we all wait, is for the American move against Iran. Anybody ought to have the greatest forebodings about this. To me, it looks like a deeply irrational and totally reckless gamble. But I think that the president himself has great difficulty controlling his emotions here. I don't think he's calculating properly. I don't think he calculates at all very much anymore, unfortunately. I think he is surrounded by people who egg him on instead of trying to restrain him. I've heard that he loses his temper very easily now and refuses to entertain advice that contradict his own instincts and suppositions. I worry that some great disaster is before us. Anyway, there we go. This is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again that all our programs, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. And you can also support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. This is where I finish today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.